Hello, you're listening to They Came From the North, the quintessentially Canadian douchebaggery-filled podcast about film directors, their goods, their bads, their uglies, as commented on by Canadians, which doesn't really mean anything. We're all film snobs at heart, after all, aren't we? Aren't we, Gabriel?
We?
Aren't we, John?
Transformers 3 forever.
Gabriel, what did I tell you about speaking Italian? God damn it.
With me are Gabriel Girard.
Bonjour.
John Mercer.
No German.
And Andrew Ford.
Speak English.
Willkommen.
We pick up where we left off last week with director Ridley Scott, who, after G.I. Jane, found himself with a little bit of traction in Hollywood again and came back in a huge way in the year 2000 with Gladiator. A star-making turn for Australian bad boy Russell Crowe. Really the first great historical epic to come along since Braveheart in 1995. It went on to a ton of Academy Award nominations, won a Best Picture, Best Actor, and really kind of established Scott's star in Hollywood. After Gladiator, people rediscovered a lot of his earlier films. And in general, his projects became, you know, really watched properties at this point. He followed it up with the 1-2 punch of Black Hawk Down and the sequel to Silence of the Lambs, the Anthony Hopkins starring Hannibal. After that, he did tackle a few smaller projects. He went on to Matchstick Man, a crime thriller starring Nicolas Cage, which garnered some really positive critical reviews, if not general public consciousness. And then the heralded follow-up to Gladiator in a spiritual sense, 2005's Kingdom of Heaven, which was somewhat crippled in its theatrical run by meddling Fox executives who were nervous after the critical and commercial failures of films like Troy and Alexander. And then, again, the smaller scale, A Good Year, followed up by American Gangster, which is a period crime drama, Body of Lies, which commented somewhat on the political and military unrest in the Middle East. Robin Hood, another Russell Crowe historical epic, which kind of retells the origin of Robin Hood in a considerably more realistic fashion. And last and certainly not least, the equally lauded and loathed alien, pseudo-alien prequel, Prometheus. We'll get right down to it. I'll start with Gabriel. You're good for the later period of Ridley Scott's career.
I'm going with American Gangster. When we talked about Cronenberg and Eastern Promises? Well, Ridley Scott shows you how you can take the gangster jar and make it your own with American Gangster. This is how you make a gangster pick, an epic gangster pick. It's like 3 hours long in the unrated edition, and it's so full of texture. And it feels so real. And I mean, from that, the first shot is just, I mean, it's Denzel just killing some guy in cold blood. And you're just like, wow, what is this movie doing? You know, you have Denzel who usually plays a good guy, and he starts by just shooting a guy point blank.
American gangster! He's a badass! Sorry. Cross-Canadian racism.
and I mean, it's basically about how Denzel picks up after his mentor dies. He was his bodyguard and his driver, so he knew all the little secrets, and he decides to step up his game and get heroin in from Bangkok. And to take over the crime and to fight it, the Italians. And on the other side of the story, you have Russell Crowe who wants to find who's distributing this new almost 100% pure stuff that's killing people, and he can sell it at half the price the Italians sell their stuff. And they're both very realized, very complex, tri-dimensional characters. It's really not the usual stock gangster cop portrayal, you know. It's so great. There's so much stuff to like in that movie.
It really makes me sad when I see it lumped in with movies like Scarface. It's so much better than Scarface, you know?
Its goals are totally different, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't want to be the huge... I mean, Scarface is like it's like a laser show, you know? it's all
comic,
over the...
It's a comic book.
Yeah, it's trying to be.
Yeah.
Well, American Gangster, I don't think is.
No,
American Gangster wants to be as real as possible and to show the impact that this... both lifestyles, because you see how Denzel deals with his family and how he deals with his wife and how what his lifestyle is doing with them. And you see how Russell Crowe is with his wife and his friends and, like, his kid and what his lifestyle is doing to them. You know, it's not just like, oh, you're the stock good cop. No, he's flawed, you know, and he wants to be a DA. And he's not just some typical stock cop. And Denzel is not just straight some bad guy snorting coke, like, all the time. He buys a house for his family and has them moving in. And he's for the most part, he's pretty much a nice guy.
He's a ruthless businessman.
Aside from the casual murder.
Yeah, what Denzel is he's a ruthless businessman.
Yeah, but he's a decent guy, you know, for the most part.
He kills immoral, you know, like he's got a morality to him. He's got a certain code, and
he's got those flashes of anger. I mean, he kills a guy in the middle of the street, for God's sake. He gets out of the restaurant.
Amazing scene. Him with Denzel and Idris Elba, man. It's just such a fantastic scene.
Two of my man crushes on screen. Right? And I'm...
But you can see that he's trying to do good with the lifestyle he's leading, you know? And it's not like some kind of hypocritical... I'm doing bad stuff, so I have to do good stuff. You feel that it comes from from inside.
I almost think it's more of a, like, he wants to help his family. He wants to help the people who came from nothing. But there's also the simple fact that, like, he's killing his customer base, you know?
Yeah.
With his product. And, I mean, that doesn't seem to register on him at all. It's like, you know, so what? They're heroin junkies. They deserve to die. You know, like, he's kind of got a little bit of that holier-than-thou thing on the go. But... for me, like, I love Denzel in the movie, but Crowe is the one who steals the show for me in that one. His cop man, Richie, I can't remember his last name.
Richie Roberts.
Roberts, yeah, but like, I think he knocks that out of the park, man.
Yeah, and you're used to seeing playing big, but in this one, he really underplays it.
Yeah, the scenes he has with Josh Brolin.
Yeah.
Just awesome stuff.
Who is rapidly becoming a great movie scumbag.
Yeah. You know, these corrupt New York City cops who come over to Jersey to extort money out of the local gangbangers and stuff, you know?
It doesn't matter how clean that suit is you put on, Josh, you still look like a dirtbag to me.
Regret shooting your father.
And as long as it is, you never really feel the length because you're really pulled in the story.
Again, yeah, he does that whole, you know, that fully realized world that just kind of sucks you in.
Well, I'm going to ask, how difficult do you think it is to turn New York into the 1970s New York?
I don't say it's easy.
Because what's hilarious is this movie came out a few months after David Fincher's Zodiac.
Yep.
Right? Which, I mean, again, was 70s San Francisco, but, you know, they're not really related pictures, but there is that bit of a connection. And American Gangster, to me, just pimp slaps the shit out of Zodiac visually.
Yeah?
I wouldn't go that far.
I think it's...
Yeah, but you don't like Legend, so...
I think...
You like Legend, so...
I think it definitely does an amazing job of realizing that period. You know, like the 70s... feel like it, like the tone, the color, and stuff like that. I think it really does a fantastic job
without being obnoxious about it.
Yeah.
And the thing is also that you have to remember is that Zodiac is mostly in the suburbs, and so it's a different visual style. You know, He's not going for the glamorous stuff like.
It's also a much darker looking movie. Zodiac is there's a lot of nighttime, a lot of dark shadows in Zodiac.
No, that wasn't a knock on David Fincher. I love David Fincher.
I'm sure we'll get to him eventually.
For sure.
I'm a huge fan of American Gangster. I think it's a great flick. But one thing I always found really awesome about it was. It's another one of those kind of slow burn movies. You know, things happen, events just kind of keep steamrolling, and then in the end when it explodes, like when Richie and his cops go on the siege of the drug house where they package up all the drugs and stuff, you know, like it's a brief sequence, but it's just such an awesome action scene, man.
I want to know, who's that actor who plays his best friend who's a junkie? Like with the mustache and everything.
Who was that?
I really liked him.
Yeah,
some kind of like Jason Patrick-y vibe or something.
and the scene where the guys find the money and stuff, you know, and you see his disdain, I guess, when Richie turns it in. He's like, oh, what are you doing? You know, you can tell that he's like, I can't believe you just did that, you know?
And that keeps on coming up. I mean, when he meets the gangsters, I think they're like, we heard you turned $1 million in or whatever.
Yeah, is that true? Was it John Hawks? No, John Hawks, I think, was one of the other cops he brings in.
Whatever. I really liked him. I think it... And that's another thing. The old Superton cast brings a lot of color to this movie. Everyone.
Yeah.
I mean, Chiwetel Ejiofor as one of Denzel's brothers. He's great. And, I mean, even Cuba Gooding Jr. actually is good in this movie.
Yeah, he is. He does actually put on a good show. How about you, John? What's your good?
Part of me really, really wanted to go with Gladiator. You know, I love Gladiator, and I think it's very unfair that Gladiator gets compared so much to Braveheart.
Oh, it's a vastly superior movie.
Yeah, it is a vastly superior movie, but also Gladiator always felt more to me like it's like the old biblical epics that we used to get.
Yeah.
And, a lot of people, I find like a lot of people who don't like Gladiator saw it in the world following Gladiator. You know, Troy had come out and not performed as well as Warner Brothers had hoped. Alexander, right?
King Arthur.
Yeah, whereas I saw Gladiator in theaters in the summer of 2000. And, you know, probably had my mind blown out the back of my fucking skull. Just... love them, you know. I get cold shivers thinking about the scene in the tent in Paris when he's talking about the dream that was Rome.
Yeah,
all this stuff. But I'm not going to go with Gladiator. I'm going to go with another movie that blew my mind out the back of my skull. I'm going to go with Black Hawk Down.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, just a masterfully shot and unbelievably well-acted movie. And here is a film where I find a lot of these military movies, you get, Longest Day Syndrome, where there's so many characters being shuffled around, you find yourself going, who the hell is that? You're forgetting who people are. I didn't have that problem in Black Hawk Down.
Yep.
And this movie, Black Hawk Down, juggles, I'd say, 15 to 20. And it all gets summed up so beautifully right at the end of it by a quick line from Eric Bana.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it ain't about the politics. It's about the man who's next to you. And it's just great, great fucking movie. I mean, say what you will about American jingoism or whatever. I mean, you're talking about a war movie directed by a British director. And a man who, if anything, is not political. And I don't know, there's just something about Black Hawk Down. I love it. It's a beautiful movie.
I think it captures...
I find that line from Bana kind of, like, I find that kind of troubling. Like, I respect the sentiment to a degree, but to me, it's kind of like, all right, it's not about the politics, it's about the guy next to you, but that kind of, like, it disassociates you from the conflict you're fighting. It's like you may as well be, you know, mowing down kids if they're also threatening to mow down the guy next to you. Like, to me, obviously that's important, but I almost find that it's almost irresponsible in a sense. It's like, well, shouldn't it be about the politics?
You're talking about Delta Force snipers, man. They're not the most well-adjusted people.
Or like, what if this was a Nazi soldier saying that line? You know,
you need to take it into
context.
You need to take it into context of the film is the thing. He's not talking about, you know, following orders or do or die or anything like that. He's talking about like this. This occurs after the longest sustained firefight since the Vietnam War that American soldiers were involved in. You know, this is in the aftermath of some pretty hairy combat. And I think the context of the line isn't so much that, you know, it's not the old school, you know, ours is not the question why, ours is about to do or die. It's not that attitude. It's more of a once the shit hits the fan, politics goes out the window. You know, and
all you've got is the man.
Is the man next to you. And I think that's actually the line.
And I get that, but to me that also, you know, I really enjoyed Black Hawk Down, but that also sort of to me illustrates how limited a film it is. And that's why I don't think I could pick it as my good, because Black Hawk Down is Black Hawk Down is like probably the most incredible combat footage I've ever seen. It is an incredibly tense movie. It's an incredibly exhilarating movie. It is filmed to perfection. But it is ultimately just that.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it really hard to care too much about it because, you know, coming from other movies where I'm given sort of a broader scope of a soldier's life and the troubles they deal with, it's almost like we're focusing in so much on this. Yeah, it's really intense, but it's kind of like, well, yeah, I guess. Like, it's awesome when you're watching it, but it's a movie that doesn't really stick with me.
I don't know what it is about Black Hawk Down. I find, like, for me, every time I watch Black Hawk Down, it's an emotionally draining experience. You know, it's one of these things that It fills me with emotion, I guess is the word, you know, and it's not a movie that you can sit back and study. It's not meant to be taken as a critical or analytical film. It's not something that's meant to be, you know, a treatise on anything. It's simply showing you these events that happened that a lot of people didn't really realize happened. I mean, how many people had heard of what went on in Mogadishu before Black Hawk Down was released as a film? You know, not very
much. But I don't buy that. Because to me, you know, the context of this movie coming out, it was coming out after Saving Private Ryan. It felt very much like it was a movie that was trying, again, to say something about war. But, you know, like you said, it's not about the politics, and it was so much about that conflict. I almost don't think it's fair to say it just wanted to tell people what was going on in Mogadishu, because it didn't, really. I mean, it sort of said, hey, this is kind of complicated and shitty, and oh my God, what's going on? Blah, blah, blah. And to me, it's a movie that doesn't quite know what it wants to be. Sometimes it feels like it wants to be more than it is, and then it never really amounts to more than that. But again,
I think in terms of
visceral filmmaking, it's phenomenal.
I think it just wants to, you know, tell you the mentality and the mental, how the modern day soldier works. You know.
And War is Hell is a very old sentiment. It's not that it's not an important one, but it felt like I find it really hard to
it's because
get
you're
my
a
fingers
liberal
really
hippie.
Sunk into
because
down.
You're a right wing liberal hippie. That's why.
I'm a right-wing liberal hippie.
Or a left-wing, whatever, you know.
This is not conversation.
That's why. You know, you're a flower child. You can't handle movies with machine guns.
I told you I love the machine gun. I can't even hear you over the smell of all this patchouli. I'm sorry.
But I mean, even the Hurt Locker goes like deeper a bit into the psychology of its characters.
Yeah,
you know?
But
even
I think
it's not political either.
I think the Hurt Locker's psychology is bullshit, though. I think the Hurt Locker's psychology is hackneyed as all hell, whereas I think Black Hawk Down actually attempted. Whether it succeeded or not, I think it at least attempted. And, I mean, I read the book twice before I ever heard of the movie, before I knew the movie was in existence. So I'm coming from that background, too. And the movie is an extremely faithful adaptation of the book, other than amalgamating a few characters. But, like, to me, it was... This is how these guys were thinking in this situation, you know, like it was how they think and how to react and, you know, stuff that, you know, we'll sit down and watch on the news or whatever and say, oh my God, how outrageous or, oh, how ridiculous or, oh, how disgraceful or whatever, you know, but they're sitting there in the situation and for them it's life or death and they've got to kind of sit there and they don't have time to think, you know, is everybody in America going to judge me for my actions in 24 hours? All they can think about is, am I going to be alive in the next 10 minutes? You know, and it's, to me, the movie kind of...
I think the idea that people... I'm almost mad that I have to put this disclaimer out there, and in this day and age, I have to. Like, this is by no means disrespectful, but the idea that people don't understand that it's a completely different experience and the in-the-moment actions are entirely different, the idea that that's not understood by a lot of people... is ridiculous. Obviously, we can't understand the experience, but the idea that that people in general don't understand that there's a distinction between the political goals and the guy on the ground, I mean, that goes back to however far back you want to go. I mean, at least World War II.
But see, the thing is, they don't. They actually don't understand that. And that's the thing. The general public only understands...
Well, those people are dumb.
They are, but they're not... This is the thing. They're the minority. These dumb people are the are the majority, sorry. You know, these are the people. These people don't understand that. These people do need it spelt out for them with crayon.
All right.
I'm sorry I didn't pick Gladiator.
All I'm saying, Steve, is frankly, I don't think the troops are doing much. And troops, bad. Or something.
Andrew, let's get on to your good.
My good is a movie I think did a much better job at sort of walking that line between political aims and the guy on the ground. It's Body of Lies.
Nice.
Fantastic choice.
It's a movie that really just came and went with no notice. And
I
didn't quite know what to think about it. I thought, you know, is it just going to be another sort of, you know, post-World Trade Center techno thriller? And what I found is that it did a really good job. It certainly wasn't subtle about it, but it did a really good job of showing the disassociation that some major sort of strategists and decision makers have from what is actually going on in the sort of worm's eye view of the so-called war on terror. I think it has a few missteps. It goes a little too Hollywood when a certain character is put in danger. That is sort of addressed in a twist toward the end where, you know, we find out that the certain character wasn't quite in the danger we thought that character was in.
Yep.
But it goes a little bit Hollywood sometimes, and it's not very subtle about sort of making that distinction. It's got, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio's character is this CIA provocateur in a way, I guess. You know, he's a guy who's really sort of trying to move the pieces on the ground and get the people they need to find out in the open through some very direct actions. And Russell Crowe is the, you know, suburban soccer dad, overweight CIA strategist who, you know, watches everything from a satellite on a giant monitor and is frequently sort of making decisions that contradicts the, I guess, the best interest of DiCaprio's character on the ground. But it's a movie that's fantastic in the way that it walks between those two worlds.
Yeah.
But, like, the thing is that... okay. It's like a cliche of the spy genre, though, to have, like, your master that's telling you to do something and, you know, to have the suits going against you. And I don't know, it didn't feel really different to me.
I don't buy that, though, because, you know, for a while we had that idea of, like, you know, you're not here, sir. You don't know. Well, we've got to do this. And that's not really what's going on.
Hoffman's character, Russell Crowe. He does have his own agenda.
The thing with Russell Crowe's character is he's not a man in black. He is a guy who, in a sense, is every bit involved in the minor on-the-ground actions as DiCaprio is. He can have as specific an effect as DiCaprio, but he doesn't have the direct sense of the repercussions, and he's removed from the humanity of it.
But I think the thing that a lot of people kind of misinterpret about the movie is DiCaprio only sees what he's witnessing on the ground. Hoffman is the opposite. He doesn't see what DiCaprio sees, but he sees the big picture.
Mm-hmm. And the other great thing about it is...
And neither one of them is right or wrong, you know? Neither one of the characters is right or wrong interactions.
It's very tempting to, and very easy, to take DiCaprio's side and think that everything DiCaprio is saying is right.
But
or everything
not.
He's doing is right. And it's absolutely not.
No.
Because he is perhaps a bit less vicious, a bit more in tune with the human cost of what's happening. But he's also not aware enough of the larger aims that he's willing to sort of to sacrifice potentially greater lives,
yeah,
in a sense, in order to save, you know, the one sort of bleeding orphan in front of him.
Yeah.
But,
and it extends this sort of, I guess, impartial and really complex assessment of how everyone's involved to every character in this. It paints as flattering and unflattering an image of Jordanian intelligence as it does of the CIA. It's certainly not an anti-American movie, and it's not it's not, strictly speaking, even an anti-fanatic movie, because it displays an understanding of where that comes from.
Mm-hmm.
It's against people who, you know, work either because of their own ego or because their own sort of oversensitivity to what's in front of them blinds them to the greater stuff, or, you know, this sort of what's the word I'm looking for? I guess a myopic approach to the larger problem. It's a really, really smart movie.
And on top of that,
it's possible that not all the plot threads tie together, but in terms of the way it approaches the material, it's very smart.
I'll congratulate you because, like, you've given me, like, I've only seen it once and a half. Last time I tried to watch it, I only watched half because, I don't know, it didn't hook me for some reason. Usually Ridley, like, gets me into his movie, but, like, I wasn't getting to it, and I was like, hey, I could watch Spy Game instead.
Nah, it's a better movie than Spy Game. And I love, you know, Spy Game.
But, like,
it's also got Mark Strong, who is completely the shit in this movie.
Badass in this movie.
And I think for me that might have been my problem, is that I, like, when I tried to rewatch it, I didn't give it the time that it needed, because you really need to see the whole thing to get the whole effect.
Yeah.
And I'm not. So I'm not really in a position to criticize it, because I didn't finish watching it. But, like, those first 40 minutes, like, I don't know, I saw maybe 40, 45 minutes when I rewatched it. And I was like, oh, not another, like, it felt like another Iraq movie to me. You know?
And see, I love the first 40 minutes or so of it. I love that little exchange that Hoffman has that starts with him in his room practicing it. and evolves into him talking to Joint Chiefs or whatever. Like, you know, the whole what's changed is that our allegedly unsophisticated enemy has cottoned on to the factually unsophisticated truth. We're an easy target, you know, and like he's got that whole, if we take the foot off the throat of this enemy for 1 minute, our world changes completely. You know, like, I thought that was such a brilliant setup. And that showed to me that Crow really knew the big picture. Crow really had, like, his character really knew what was what on a global scale. And then you had that awesome.
Yeah, I'll just chalk it up to maybe not being in the right mood when I try to rewatch it. Maybe I should have seen Gladiator instead. Because, like, when I tried to rewatch it, I was like, hey, what's the difference between this and, like, Green Zone or Traitor or,
intelligence. You know. Intelligence and the want to provoke some manner of thought.
you definitely have to watch the entire thing. It develops and it deliberately tries to mislead you.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't. You don't come out of it saying, "Oh, well, actually, you know, Russell Crowe's character was a great guy," because he's not a great guy. But it tries to trick you into thinking he's an awful guy, and he's not that either. He's someone who has substantial blind spots, who tends to blunder into places and spoil certain things, but at the same time, he's vastly more equipped than DiCaprio's character to judge the broader cost of what these actions are going to have.
Well, to quote something that could be in a DVD verdict review, I shall give it another day in court. For sure.
Wow. I salute you for your open-mindedness.
I'm going to chime in with my good here. And this one, I have to say, it is the director's cut, not the original theatrical cut. I will specify ahead of time. But I have to go with Kingdom of Heaven. That, to me, was just about the perfect motion picture. The director's cut of that film was just, from start to finish, it enraptured me. Like, I was completely enthralled by it. I thought the characters were great. I thought the storyline was great. Beautiful looking film. One of his nicer looking movies for sure. And just the whole, like, the commentary, I guess, on, you know, in particular the Crusades and how, like, it's still kind of like the aftershocks of the Crusades are still felt to modern day. You know, it's one of those movies, and I mean, Ridley, again, he's famous for ambiguity. He doesn't condemn one side or the other. He shows the good and bad of both. And, I mean, much like Body of Lies. And just how he has the characters kind of evolve as the film goes on. And, I mean, you don't get any of the character evolution in the theatrical cut. The theatrical cut is just kind of a tour of, you know, Jerusalem during the time of the Crusades. Whereas with the director's cut, you get this real character piece. You get this real, like, you see the evolution of Balian from, you know, disgraced engineer turned blacksmith and, you know, someone who lost a loved one, become, you know, this real understander of the human condition, from someone who suffered to someone who kind of feels for people, to someone empathic. You know, he really kind of evolves as a character. He's not just this mute witness like he was in the theatrical cut. Eva Green's character is an amazing character, really, really beautiful character. And I mean, again, the theatrical cut, you have no idea why she's gone batshit loco in the final act, but in the director's cut, you get a full indication of her as a character. Liam Neeson, early on, he's fantastic. He knocks out of the park with this, you know, the mentor role that he does so well. But here, I just found he was on fire. And just the overall scope of the film, like what it has to say about, you know, Christian and Muslim relationships and stuff, it doesn't damn either side. It really kind of, it wants you to kind of take a step back and look at what these sides are preaching and what their actions are, and whether, you
as
know,
an atheist, I damn both sides.
Yeah. You know, you have the awesome line from Hospitalier fairly early on in the movie. You have, from the bishop, I sometimes wonder, would Christ do it justly? You know, like or thusly. It's one of those things where, you know, it questions the philosophies behind religion and what led these people to wars, like the vanity behind different faiths and stuff, but it doesn't condemn them. It doesn't, you know, it kind of leaves it up to you to make up your mind. Are these people just or unjust? Are they right or, you know?
I find one of the stupider criticisms that had been leveled against the movie was that it was anachronistic to have these characters sort of acknowledge the positive aspects of the other, which I think is just idiotic. There's no reason that when you're making a historically based film that you have to make it in the mindset of that time, or necessarily have those characters be of the mindset of that time.
They'd all be a bunch of unlikable, racist, misogynistic.
They'd barely
racist.
Be able to speak. They'd all be illiterate. I mean, well, all the Christians would be illiterate anyway.
Yeah, it is. It's,
and they'd just be like, "Brr, fucking darkies."
But I have one point of contention with Kingdom of Heaven, and it has two words, and that is Orlando Bloom.
I knew you were going to say that, and I think that's another criticism that drives me crazy. I think he does a fantastic job. I think he does a great job with the material. I don't think at any point in time is he ever trying to be, you know, Pretty Boy Orlando Bloom or anything like that.
No. I don't have anything against Orlando Bloom. Okay, I give every actor a fair trial. It's just I think he doesn't have the charisma and the assurance to make the role he's playing real.
I agree with Gabe, and it's absolutely not a Orlando Bloom is a pretty boy, you know, and shouldn't be there. It is every bit. He did not have the sort of theatrical depth to really make me buy his transformation throughout the movie.
And now in the theatrical cut, I would have agreed with you.
In terms of the script and the direction, I felt the character was developing, but I didn't feel it out of that performance.
I will say I agree with the theatrical cut, but the director's cut, I do think he was perfectly fine. I really had no issues.
I've only seen the director's cut.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I've only seen the director's cut.
And maybe that's a part of it. Maybe it's where I come from the theatrical cut first into the director's cut, and I see the growth in the character there, whereas in the theatrical cut there was nothing. You know, he was a tour guide. You know,
I think that there's like a spark. There's like a spark missing in the character. You know, like I actually like him in the Pirates film, and you know, he brings a certain aura, you know, in those movies, and even as Legolas. And there's like a spark missing in that character that should be there, like a foundation that Orlando Bloom doesn't bring to it.
I can see what you're saying.
I think if you'd put Cillian Murphy or Killian Murphy, however you pronounce his name, in that role.
No.
Oh man.
He could have been amazing.
I can't picture him selling the physicality and stuff of it. He just doesn't have the posture and stuff.
I don't buy Orlando Bloom's physicality. He feels he certainly doesn't feel like a leader.
He's got that he's got that regalness to him though. He's got that sense of nobility to him, that knighthood kind of, you know, that God-given rightness to him, you know?
Could you imagine Heath Ledger instead? That's all I'm saying.
Yes, yeah, Heath Ledger, definitely, no doubt.
I just need to add that once it's old enough that it can be justified me backhanding my son, I'm teaching him the Knight's Oath.
Are you going to slap him at the end of it?
Of course I am.
How
else is he going to remember it?
That was the part that leapt out at me. It was like, and here we're trying to make a memorable line, and it rang false to me. But again, there's a great deal to admire in Kingdom of Heaven.
And that's one of the few, that whole little oath is one of the few things that's actually taken from history.
No figure. Is the hitting him and saying, and that's so you'll remember it? Is that taken from history?
No, I don't know about that. I have no idea about that.
Yeah,
but I know that particular oath is.
I think we can assume that landowners and lords slapped the shit out of their kids.
It's not the fact that slapping happened. It's, you know.
But, I mean, even some of, like, the second kid, like, Jeremy Irons, man, was great in it. And, of course, I got to talk about Edward Norton. Edward Norton was just absolutely phenomenal. And the fact
that I didn't have to look at his
Brendan fucking Gleeson.
Yes, and Martin Soskis.
Brendan Gleeson terrified me in this movie.
He's terrifying. I mean, everybody but Orlando, basically.
Yeah. No,
yeah, the poor German guy at the beginning. I wanted to watch more adventures of him.
Yeah, and Kevin McKidd's character, who just kind of disappears after the shipwreck. We assume he died in the shipwreck, I guess. You know, but like some great stuff in this movie. Just I just think it's an amazing piece of work.
And I also really, really love the. We spoke about it earlier. You know, the how it's kind of up to you to decide who's right and who's wrong.
Yeah.
You know, we when we meet Salahadin in the movie.
Oh my God, he's fantastic.
He's painted with the same sort of regal air.
Yeah.
What's
the actor's name again? He does a fantastic job. In
that. Ghassan Massoud.
Alexander Siddig was his right-hand in it, wasn't he?
He was fantastic, too. Fantastic. Really, really, really well done. You know, like, you had really great personalities on both sides.
Yeah, but the guy who played Solid, man, that, I did not give you permission to drink.
Yeah. I did not give the cup to him.
Cold as ice.
It was wicked. It was absolutely fantastic. But it was
you
just...
want to talk about Denzel shooting a guy in the face, an American gangster?
But I just, so much about it, I mean, to me, like, all the entrances and exits were completely memorable. It was just, it's one of those movies that just, again, sucks you into its headspace, you know?
We should also note that in the theatrical cut, Ava Green, who is absolutely gorgeous in this movie, is nothing more than Balian's fuck toy.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the director's cut, she has a beautiful, beautiful character arc.
Yeah, really, really nice. And I got to say, I love the last line of the film, the very last little piece of text, the "even today, peace remains elusive in the kingdom of heaven." I thought that was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that was really, really cool. Just great movie. Really, really enjoyed it. Move on to bads, I guess. I will start with Gabriel.
I have to go with Hannibal. Even if I really like that movie, I think it's... it's got some major flaws, but I really like it. It's Granging all at its finest, you know? It's like, oh, we're putting on a show here.
Yeah.
And it's so beautifully filmed and atmospheric. And I think it got a lot of backlash because of the Silence of the Lambs phenomenon at the time. And I think it gains from being removed from that phenomenon. Where, like, when you watch it on its own, Julianne Moore is Clarice Starling, you know, in this movie.
And you don't have to listen to that really annoying accent.
And basically, the main thing I dislike about it is that, first of all, I feel that as often with Ridley, there's a longer cut somewhere. It feels a little bit too streamlined, that there should be more meat to what we're seeing. Like, it goes into chase mode a little bit too fast. You know, instead of just trying to find where he is, that's the most interesting part of the movie is the cat and mouse game, and I feel it gets to like let's go after him a bit too quickly.
And that was the problem with it as well, actually.
And that all last 20 minutes, of course.
Yeah.
The infamous brain eating scene.
Totally anticlimactic.
Yeah, I just feel that should have been more of a kind of like in Silence of the Lambs and the I'm having an old friend for dinner. They don't spend 20 minutes watching, you know, Anthony Hopkins cut the top of dude's skull off. Right, it's more just of a little menacing, oh yeah, that shithead's going to get his.
But there's even in that last 20 minutes, I like the fact that Clarice still, you know, she gets up against him and she doesn't, she's hopped up on like morphine or something and she still tries to hold her ground and he has to like lock her hair into the fridge to stop her from getting at him.
I always found that Hannibal, the movie can never really defend, I mean, a lot is probably blamed on the Thomas Harris novel because I find...
Yeah.
It's same deal with Silence of the Lambs and even with Red Dragon.
And Manhunter.
Yeah, who the fuck is the villain supposed to be? You know, you've got, what's the Italian actor?
Giancarlo Giannini.
Yeah, you know, he's fucking great in Hannibal, but you got him, and then it jumps to Gary Oldman, completely unrecognizable.
Yeah,
Gary Oldman
is definitely the villain in this one, I think.
Yeah.
But then you got then it jumps to Ray Liotta. It's like, is every single man in the Hannibal verse outside of Hannibal a completely reprehensible?
Oh, and really
shit stick.
Ray Liotta's character is, you know, earlier we're talking about three-dimensional. He's totally one-dimensional.
I don't think it's fair to call Giancarlo Giannini's character reprehensible. I think that's a bit unfair to him.
That's Ray Liotta's,
A little too ruthlessly ambitious for his own good.
What's his line, Ray Liotta?
Corn pone.
Corn pone. Oh my god, that's horrible.
I just hate that word.
But yeah, I mean, and it's one of Hans Zimmer's most different scores. I think it's really beautiful, especially the piano stuff that he's doing in there. It's haunting, and I don't know. It's a really interesting film. I find that's been unfairly panned.
Yeah, I'll get to more of my thoughts on Hannibal in a little while.
Same here.
John, what about you? What have you got for a bad?
This is a really, really difficult choice for me because, honestly, as much as I'm a super nerd for Blade Runner and Alien, I feel that in his renaissance, Ridley's become a better director. His later stuff is just, most of it's, you know, knocked straight out of the park. It's that quality. You know, sometimes I miss the shafts, light, and the smog a bit, but for my bad, I had to choose between Matchstick Men and A Good Year, and I'm probably going to go with A Good Year just for the fact that I don't give two shits about wine.
That's only a small part of it, though.
Yeah, I know, but it's just not that it wasn't accessible. It's just goddamn boring movie, right? It wasn't what I wanted to see, and that's not saying it's a bad movie by any stretch of the imagination. It's you know, he was trying something different, and it wasn't something that captured my imagination or held my attention for very long.
I can dig it.
At least in Matchstick Men, as much as I hate Nicolas Cage, that movie's got Sam.
Oh, you're awful.
Sam Rockwell's fucking genius performance and
Alison Lohman. Sam Rockwell wiping the phone on his bus before handing it to Nicolas Cage. Genius.
And like Alison Lohman, how old is she? She's like 22, 23. She's older than she's playing.
Yeah.
She's fantastic.
Matchstick Men was a crime thriller and was somewhat interesting to me. A Good Year was just, you know, start the movie up.
See,
wake up on the couch at 3 o'clock in the morning and then get up and go to bed.
Well, I really liked it, but I've got all that French Marcel Pagnol background, so my opinion doesn't really count here.
I kind of liked Goodyear too, and it was a movie that I resisted watching for a really long time. It was something that I kind of, you know, like, it's like, yeah, this movie does not appeal to me in the slightest. And
I don't want to watch some movie about a blimp.
But no, it just, it seemed like slightly out of Ridley's wheelhouse, so I really didn't have a whole lot of interest in it. And it was, I mean, it definitely was, but so was Matchstick Man, really. And I wound up kind
of... I think he's got quite a bit of affection for it. He really felt sort of a bit bitter the way it was treated when it came out. People kind of dismissed it. And I think that may be partly because they were saying, oh, a Ridley Scott movie, well...
Yeah,
this isn't what I was expecting.
Ridley Scott, Russell Crowe, you know.
I think it's the movie where you can see that he's a European the most, you know.
Yeah.
It's really got that old world flavor. When I did my review way back in the jury room. I'm like, to use a wine metaphor, it's not champagne, but it's not piquette either. it's a perfectly fine, $20 wine, you know?
Yeah.
That you enjoy with a good meal. It's nothing spectacular, but it's, while it lasts, it's good.
Yeah, and
are you wearing a beret right now, Gabe?
And that's the thing. It's a movie that, you know, it doesn't...
No, but I smoke Gauloise.
it doesn't overstay its welcome. It's perfectly well acted, it's perfectly well performed, and it's perfectly well written, but in the end, it's ultimately disposable.
It's just that John is too comfortable on his couch.
Sorry, you were saying something? I was asleep.
What about you, Andrew? What have you got for your bad?
This is a tough one. I mean, almost as a contrast to John, I find a lot of Ridley's movies almost achieve sort of greatness and they're just held back. So I kind of feel like I have a lot of choices for bad. I'm tempted to go with Robin Hood. It's one I just watched recently. It got a lot of bad press when it came out. And then it got some very passionate defense from a certain St. John's person.
I'm far from the only one.
I know.
In fact, I was one of the tail end people.
I find Robin Hood does a lot of things right, but it does a couple of things really, really wrong. And it mostly comes in the last sort of quarter of the film. It's interesting in the sort of way it tries to an almost Robin Hood prequel. It's everything leading up to the Robin Hood we know.
That's kind of held in contention too.
Sorry?
That's kind of held in contention as well, actually. That's not something that's...
The Robin Hood movie, we know
it literally ends with him being declared an outlaw and saying, yeah. And so the legend begins.
Yes, but that's also... Yeah, I'll let you finish what you're saying and then I'll chime in because that's...
Were those studio mandates?
No. No, they weren't.
Okay. I find that it doesn't know how to mix... at times it strives for realism, and then at other times it indulges itself in a way that a more fantastical kind of legend type treatment would do. And I find it doesn't really walk that line very well. It does a very good job of sort of creating this very realistic medieval world and putting the Robin Hood coming back. And so you're given this sense that you should be looking at this as a recontextualized Robin Hood, like a Robin Hood that's in a more grounded sort of medieval world. And then we get Maid Marian leading a troop of woodland orphans into an actual battle that is basically the medieval reenactment of D-Day. Like that's ridiculous. I'm sorry.
And I actually in my review I called out the Higgins boats as being a bit retarded. And I received feedback and a web link actually proving that these things existed and they were off the shores of England at this time.
It's not merely the boats. Although that's, you know, there was maybe this was the entire landing was filmed as a medieval Saving Private Ryan.
Oh, hell
there are
yeah.
Shots that replicated from Saving Private Ryan with arrows in place of bullets.
But it was just an awesome action sequence.
it was D-Day, and it just felt a little too close to be taken seriously. And then you have the whole Maid Marian going all Eowyn and apparently just putting on a full knight's regalia, which isn't something that anyone could just do, physically.
She grew up with boys.
No, physically. If you were a large, strong man, you couldn't just jump up and be effective in that role. You had to be really well trained in very specific ways. And
you hated Thelma and Louise, didn't you?
You hate women.
And the fact that she's leading unarmored orphans who are basically like doing like street urchin knife fighting against guys in chainmail with broadswords.
Hey, whatever to free your country, man.
It's ridiculous.
Have we even brought up Max von Sydow yet?
If the rest of the movie had played in a more sort of recognizably like grandiose sort of legend making way, but it felt far too grounded, and the fact that it was sort of all revolving around this sort of pseudo Magna Carta history, it really felt like it didn't know where it wanted to stand. That's how I felt.
My thing with Robin Hood, and this is one of the interpretations, this is again, you know, this is where you get into Ridley Scott and his ambiguity and his, you know, a little bit more thought and a little bit more, I guess, pretense goes into his films. The whole "and so the legend began" and the whole this being a prequel to the Robin Hood myth, what was originally intended was that this would be the real story that inspired the Robin Hood myth. Not so much
there were
like
a lot of what was originally supposed to in this production.
No, but this that particular, like the whole reason for the ending, and so the legend began and stuff, it's meant to more portray, you know, the realistic period in which this person, this noble, lived who inspired the legend of Robin Hood. Not after this comes the story you all know. That story is myth. That story is what this story mutated
that,
into.
That may be the intention, but in that case I would say that he didn't achieve his goal effectively. That he inadvertently gave the wrong message in ending his film.
And again, it can be an ambiguous thing. It can be something that's open to interpretation. You know,
because, I mean, you usually see, like, since he gets married and under the sheriff's nose, you can see the sheriff becoming the real bastard after the story is finished.
Can you tell me why the Sheriff of Nottingham was played by Jason Segel's twin?
But yeah, John.
He could have followed around by Muppet.
John piped up and asked about Max von Sydow. Max von Sydow was great in this movie.
Absolutely amazing.
Oh, he was great. There were a lot of really great things in this movie. Like I said, I mean, I'm calling out the things that I feel make it bad, but there was a lot of very good. It's mostly an extremely well written movie. Mostly an extremely well acted movie. But again, I just feel that it loses its footing a bit.
I think it suffers from having the Robin Hood name attached to it, and the fact that there is just because it started as a Robin Hood project. You know, like I think it does kind of suffer from that. I think it would have been better served under another title.
Mm-hmm.
But it was almost.
And I also felt that Russell Crowe, you know, possibly in an effort to, again, sort of make this is the real story that inspired, he really underplayed this far too much. I felt he was really kind of just seemed sort of just morose and generally uncomfortable most of the time. But I
think that's part of the point. I mean, this guy's coming from, who knows, all of them from the Crusades, and suddenly he's married to this woman.
No, but I understand that, but I feel that the performance didn't capture that. I felt like it was like humorless Robin and the Three Stooges, when Little John and Will Scarlet and what's his face came into the picture, and they were all being. I also felt, you know, there were a few times when the humor just went a bit overboard. In contrast to what was going on around it.
So it was more Braveheart than Gladiator.
Yeah. Also, I know you're a big fan of Ridley's new composing partner. What's his name? Streitenfeld?
Mark Streitenfeld, yeah.
I was far too aware. I don't know if it's more obvious in the director's cut, which is what I watched. But I was really aware of what seemed like a very sort of simplistic approach to scoring in this. I felt he came up with some very strong sort of motifs and themes and stuff for different arcs, but it kind of felt like he was just like, all right, in funny mode. Press the funny theme. All right, now it's a little bit tense. Press that one. I felt like I was hearing the same thing over and over again, just sort of got in. It didn't feel like a score that was sort of considered as something that should drive the whole.
I didn't have a problem with it. I thought it was fine.
I didn't even notice it.
And that's the thing with Streitenfeld. Streitenfeld keeps things simple. He underscores. He's not like... You know, you don't get stuff like the 9-minute battle sequence in Gladiator with the big giant, you know, Mars, the bringer of war. That's not his style.
Well,
and
it felt like it drew more attention to itself because comedy moments, tense moments. It was like it was sort of saying like, all right, here we go. This is it. Like it really felt jarring.
I didn't have that problem at all.
Well, you're a lucky man.
I'm more on Steve's side of you with Robin, and I really, really liked it.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun movie. And, I mean, you know, it's got just enough of the realism in there to kind of pull you into it like most of Ridley's movies do.
This is my bad. This is my ugly. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's got just enough to pull you in, but it's just got just enough absurdity in there, too, you know, to keep it entertaining, to keep it loose. It's not Kingdom of Heaven 2, you know?
Mm-hmm. No.
My bad, I had originally thought maybe Robin Hood. Then I kind of leaned towards Matchstick Man. But I ultimately settled on A Good Year. And pretty much for the same reasons John stated.
Or A Good Snooze, as John called it.
Yeah, like, it wasn't a bad movie. I kind of it suffers to me from the same flaws as Someone to Watch Over Me. It's not a Ridley film, you know. It's not in his wheelhouse. It's not thoughtful. It's not really poignant at all. It's just kind of a vanity picture. But unlike Someone to Watch Over Me, it is visually stunning. It is a beautiful film, you know?
And Albert Finney is great in it.
Yeah, he is. He is. He's really good. And, I mean, all the performances were pretty good in it, you know? And I enjoyed Russell Crowe's character arc, even though it was pretty contrived. You know, big businessman, comes back to rural France and falls in love with the countryside, remembers what it was like as a kid, and says enough of this whole stock market crap, and I'm just going to go be a country boy again. You know, like it's...
And he meets a nice French girl.
Yeah, you know, settles down with a nice French girl and solves a mystery about a bottle of wine and whatever. You know, but it was an okay flick. I mean, I did enjoy it for what it was, but it just, you know, it kind of...
Yeah.
That and Matchstick Man, same thing. You know, I enjoyed both movies for what they were, but they weren't something I pull off of the shelf very often to watch again, you know? On to uglies. And I'm going to start with John.
You would.
Just seeing if you're still awake, John. Oh.
It's just word association. Sorry.
Oh, my ugly. Prometheus. No.
You stole my bit.
You stop that.
No. And I can also steal another Forbes bit and say it was the director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven, but I'm not going to do that either. I'm going to go with Hannibal because despite whatever we spoke at great length last episode about the Ridley Scott touch, and despite, you know, him bringing magic to what was a literary mess by Thomas Harris, and despite, you know, I was kind of digging the whole idea of a movie celebrating basically a super fiend. And it's just Hannibal is just it's a fucking mess.
It really is.
I'm going to jump in here too because I have also chosen Hannibal as my ugly, so I'm going to be back up.
It's got some cool parts to it. It really does have some cool parts, and I mean, coming from a design standpoint, I love the opening credits.
Oh yeah,
amazing bit of work there. I believe by one of Ridley's students at RSA.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And great little opening sequence. I love the shot of the Italian cop when he plummets out through the window.
Bowels in or out.
I even love the repeated use of okie dokie.
Yeah.
I pretty much love every part of Hannibal that surrounds Giancarlo Giannini's character.
Yeah, like, that bit in Italy is fucking amazing.
It's
right?
Amazing, and I wish that was the movie that we continued to see.
Yeah,
but all the Ray Liotta, all the Mason Verger, the whole opening with Clarice and the like weird like drug queen pin baby holding Mac 10 firing stuff. Oh, just, it's a mess.
Yeah.
With a sweet, sweet Andy center.
I also chose Hannibal. Hannibal was also Hannibal. And I'm on board with Hannibal. Even the opening shootout and all of that stuff, I am totally on board with Hannibal until the Verger storyline is resolved. And then that whole tail end just completely and utterly destroys what up to that point was a pretty chilling movie. It goes completely off the rails into Looney Tunes land.
I don't disagree, because that is absolutely the worst part. But I find the way Mason Verger was treated, and I mean, this may very well come out of the novel.
Oh, it's definitely from the novel.
But I mean, that doesn't excuse it, because they're still responsible for the movie they're making. I feel like this was a character that was introduced in order to sort of satisfy the supposed audience's desire for the most grotesque sort of experience they could have. It's a repulsive character, but he's not a particularly interesting repulsive character, I find. Like, he's just awful. He looks like this gutted fish.
Those makeup effects were great.
They're amazing. I mean, credit to the makeup artist. Like, it's phenomenal, but I just find it's so absurd. His whole scheme that he has is just ridiculous. He's like the dumbest Bond villain that was ever conceived.
That's why I called it Drunk and All.
You know, but I feel like the joy, like, there wasn't enough joy. It was mean-spirited. It wasn't like that sort of, like, joyful meanness. It was just this, like, well, let's just wallow in ugliness.
This is rude. That's Harris, though. That's what Harris does.
Yeah.
You know, that's
I know, but I that may be Harris, but...
Yeah, that's his thing.
Ridley Scott's making the movie. He's got to make the movie.
It's like, can you imagine if, like, Clive Barker had a hold of that script instead?
Yeah.
To me, God, it's just, it's such a lame idea, you know? Oh, the only surviving victim of Hannibal Lecter. It's like that crappy American Psycho direct-to-DVD sequel they made.
Yeah.
Did you guys notice Osama bin Laden on the top wanted list?
I sure did.
And that's in what it came out. It came out before September 11th.
It was, yeah. I think it was February. It was a February
release. Yeah.
It was about a month, I think, a month or 2 months after Black Hawk Down.
And, you know, another thing I wanted to bring up, and this is something that I feel is straight up Ridley's fault. I don't know if he thought it was an attempt to sort of just increase the Italian flavor, or if he was attempting to make some kind of shot at depth, but there is a lot of ridiculous, like, Christian imagery. The most egregious example is Hannibal sort of strapped to that thing, surrounded, you know, in the middle of this pig pen, you know, crucified, and it's just this kind of, like, oh, reverent, like, oh, it's Hannibal Lecter crucified like Jesus.
Well, he's got the Dante connection in the speech he makes. I think he was going for a kind of a medieval, you know, thing going on.
Yeah.
Like the theater of the absurd that was going on at that time.
You know, there's theater of the absurd and there's theater of the walkout.
You guys are breaking my heart.
No, I'm kind of with you on that one, Gabriel. I kind of got your back on that one.
I don't find it comes together, though. Like, I get that, you know, certainly in terms of the connection with Hannibal's sort of new identity as the art teacher and the presentation he gives and, you know, the medieval imagery, but I feel like it comes off as cheap shots at satire or pathos or depth, who knows?
Well, I think that issue again comes from Harris. I think that is just, it's the nature of that character. It's an ugly character.
That's how he chose to shoot it.
He chose to shoot it based on a pre-existing screenplay that he wasn't allowed to change.
And then that
And also, I'm pretty sure Harris has got some. I mean, he is the writer. He's probably got some rights locked down in his contract.
I'm also pretty sure this was like Dino De Laurentiis' last film. So yeah.
But this is not a defense for the film.
Yeah.
Anybody know who actually wrote that script? Because I mean, Steve Zalin,
didn't Mamet have a hand in it?
Mamet, but there's nothing of David Mamet in that film.
There was Mamet for a while, Steve Zalian for a while. There were 14 different writers, I believe.
Ooh.
But it was a mess. I mean, because Demme was attached for a long time, man, before he finally bailed on it. And what it was is basically he and De Laurentiis went to Harris and offered him, you know, $5 million, some absurd chunk of money before the book was even written. And he sat there cackling with glee, rubbing his hands, and decided to make the novel kind of a critique on the whole Hollywood machine. You know, you guys paid me $5 million for a book that's going to be completely unfilmable. And it was done deliberately. It was done out of spite. It was mean-spirited. And that was the thing. Like, Demme had so much trouble just trying to get it to work. And then when he walked, of course, Jodie Foster walked. And, I mean, after that, I mean, you know, you're making a sequel to Silence of the Lambs, and you don't have your central actress anymore. You don't have – didn't she win an Oscar for Silence of the Lambs?
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, how do you follow that, right? How can you possibly follow that and succeed? And I think what they tried to do then was they tried to basically distance themselves from Silence of the Lambs as much as possible, you know?
And it feels totally
without getting rid of Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, yeah.
It should have been Brian Cox.
That's what I was about to say. It really should have been Brian Cox. But no, I mean, Hopkins, and you can tell Hopkins is in his glee. He's reveling in every minute of it, you know? But it's one of those movies that I think it couldn't have worked. There's no, like, I don't think there's anybody else out there who really could have made it work because the source was so flawed to begin with. I mean, he deliberately wrote a shitty novel, you know? And you have the question, where does the line stop, you know, like how much do we change and how much do we erase and rewrite and whatever before it becomes a completely different animal entirely. And I know another big deal with it was that Ridley was brought on late. Ridley came in really late, and it was kind of a situation where he was still in the midst of filming Black Hawk Down, and De Laurentiis approached him and told him, you know, I got to know within 48 hours whether you're going to shoot this film or not, you know. So he kind of jumped out of one project. I think he finished shooting on Black Hawk Down one day, went into editing for a day, and then the next day he was on the set shooting Hannibal. You know, it's kind of one of those things where it all came together really fast, you know?
And it still feels really like a Ridley movie.
It does definitely have that Ridley feel to it, but it doesn't have that narrative style.
Yeah,
it doesn't have Ridley's narrative. Like, you can tell there were no passes done on that screenplay. You know, he just basically shot what he was given, you know?
You got Ridley's style, but you don't got his substance.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Right?
The sizzle with no steak.
Well, I have to say,
if anything, there was too much steak in this movie.
It was definitely meaty.
Well, I'm a horror freak, and I love the grotesque, so that's why maybe I like it more than
Gabriel,
you guys.
There's
something
face,
really
his
odd.
His face
in the way that
like
I see
it
this movie.
Was constructed out of boneless, skinless chicken breast. It was disgusting.
Like, Cronenberg's not a movie. It's large chunks of Hannibal, but it's just it ends up being awful.
Yeah, it is a mess. It is a mess of a flick.
Like I said, Cronenberg looked at Mason Verger's face and said, "Dude, that's fucked up."
have we got an ugly left? Have we, Gabe?
It's me, but I seriously, I've got nothing.
You got nothing for us?
I've got nothing.
Good man.
At first, I was gonna go with Body of Life because I couldn't get into it last time. But Andrew changed my mind, so I've got nothing.
Yes, victory.
I really have nothing. I mean, for
you
me,
have the courage to hate on Gladiator? Coward.
I didn't
forgot to hate Gladiator.
I didn't have the fortitude to sit through it again, so I'll just...
No, I thought I hated Gladiator, guys. When I sat down and watched it, I realized I was thinking about Alexander.
Hey!
This
is mean. Come on now.
I hate Gladiator, but I'm just not prepared to run the gauntlet.
You thought Black Rain was bad. Black Rain didn't have Richard Harris in it.
Both barrels.
Richard Harris.
But
all exams are canceled.
You've been whispering about Rome again, Bob?
For me, especially in the second part of his career, it's really hard to find an ugly because all of those movies are pretty good.
Yeah,
you know,
he's
from pretty good to exceptional.
Yeah. On that note, I guess we should sum it up with final thoughts on director Ridley Scott. And I mean, this can go from beginning to end. Gabriel, anything?
Well, he's an extraordinary visualist, and he's got a great eye and a great sense for atmosphere and world building. Sometimes he probably needs a better hand on the script. He needs a really good script to make a really good movie, I think. I look forward to his other projects because I actually like him when he's outside his comfort zone. I like to see him playing stuff like Matchstick Men or Thelma and Louise, or a good year to see him try his hand at something else than the epics or sci-fi. So I'm very interested.
Anything other than more satellite views.
And for a while, I thought he was stuck in the rut with the epics. You know, not that I don't enjoy them, but then I was like, oh, is this all he's going to do now? You know? Because, I mean, I like them, but after a while, you know, if he's only doing one kind of picture, I think he runs the risk of becoming boring.
Yeah.
Well, Gabe, you're in luck because the next thing he's doing involves... it's like a legal thriller written by Cormac McCarthy.
Yep. The Council, isn't it?
Fassbender and Brad Pitt are the stars, and Javier Bardem is in there.
I'll be there opening day.
It does sound pretty awesome.
Yeah.
How about you, John? Thoughts?
Me?
Yep.
I think, you know, like Scott came into, what did you say, directed The Duelist at the age of 40?
Yep.
The guy had over 2,000. I mean, last week I was impressed when I talked about John McTiernan and had over 200 commercials.
Yeah.
Scott had over 2,000. You want to talk about, you know, like a consummate student of the game, right? This is a guy who went in from the ground level and learned every single job on his way. This is a man who knows every job on a film set, and I think he's just gotten better with age. I think movies in Scott's catalog that are bad in spite of Ridley Scott. You know, even something like Legend is just so unbelievably gorgeous that you can't look away from it. Right? Or something like Hannibal, that's a goddamn mess. It's just, there's still chunks to it where just sheer artistic shines through. He's my favorite director, right? The guy's just a brilliant filmmaker, and I gotta say I really enjoy how he kind of jumps around genres a bit. Yes, like Gabe said, there was that period where he seemed to be stuck in a historical rut, but not even so much a rut, I think, because, you know, just shooting what he enjoys.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, like, I mean, people kind of fail to remember that there was stuff in between those historical movies too, right?
Yeah. And like I can't believe none of us got into Prometheus. That's not something I was really looking forward to. Cause just...
Well, I haven't seen it yet, so...
Okay.
I wouldn't want to...
No, I don't want to spoil a single thing. So.
Andrew, how about you?
Ridley Scott, the director, he obviously started out with an extremely strong series of punches. Alien and Blade Runner, and although I haven't seen it, by all accounts, The Duelist as well. I think he has certainly gotten a better sense of sort of complexity into his films as he's done. But I think he does have a few tend to lead him the wrong way every now and then. But for the most part, I mean, he's an extremely consistent, extremely strong director. There's probably nobody touch him visually working right now. And I just love the idea of Steve and John sitting down watching a Ridley movie and then the credits roll and they both light up a cigarette.
I smoke cigars, Andrew. I smoke cigars. Steve smokes the ganja.
No comment.
Out of a pipe.
I plead the fifth.
The pipe is made of ivory.
But yeah, Ridley, anytime a new Ridley movie comes out, I'm intrigued. So
I'll chime in with the last word, because, I mean, you guys know how I feel about Scott's movies.
You're kind of here and there, aren't you? You don't really care.
But no, I think...
Not a fan. Not at all.
I've said it before, not directly in relation to Scott, but in terms of, like, directing in general, and, like, the signs of a really accessible and also successful filmmaker are, you know, the ability to blend accessibility with self-indulgence and to do it successfully. And I think there are very few people out there. I'd give it to maybe Alfred Hitchcock and Steven Spielberg above Ridley. But he can really make a project that's both appealing without being too pretentious or being too high-minded, but also ambiguous and intelligent enough that it doesn't feel hackneyed and recycled and typical Hollywood. You know, the guy is, he's masterful at blending, like, high concept ideas with just a purely accessible picture. He can make things, you know, like Blade Runner, where you can watch it as a thriller, a cop thriller or whatever, or you can sit down and ponder the real, like, the philosophical background and such behind it. Or, I mean, even stuff like Kingdom of Heaven, or, you know, so many of his movies just have this layer of ambiguity beneath them. And it's subtle. I mean, his technique is not subtle, but just the way he buries stuff in his films is kind of subtle. And, I mean, of course, the king of it all would probably be Prometheus, which has really been hotly debated. But the simple fact for me, like, I mean, at the age he's at now and the amount of movies that he's had under his belt, for him to return to sci-fi for the first time since 1982 and make a film that everybody is talking about, that in and of itself tells me he was successful. You know, mm-hmm. that in and of itself tells me that, yeah, Prometheus knocked it out of the park. And I think in 25 years' time or 30 years' time, it's going to be as fondly remembered as Alien and Blade Runner are now. You know, it's one of those films. But, I mean, everything he's done, like, I mean, everything in his body of work has some manner of a redeeming quality behind it. It's whether it be Legend with its beautiful visuals or Hannibal with its just, you know, that first act.
Except maybe for someone to watch over me.
Yeah, except maybe for someone to watch. Even that, the final act of that movie was pretty good. So, but you know, like he from the get go, right from Duelist, he showed an assured sign. He showed control, and he just, you know, there were times that I think his ambitions outstripped his capability to deliver on them, and I think maybe he was a little too high concept, and I think those were his failings. When you have movies like Legend, where he does kind of buy into flights of fancy a little bit, and he's a director who I think needs to stay a little more grounded to be accepted, you know, for his work to succeed. And it just overall, though, you know, like, I mean, even Saitneta's like nitpicking. The guy is just, I think he's a master at a craft. I think he's really one of the true greats that's living today, you know. I think he's done.
So you do like him?
I've never met him. But, you know, he appeals to me. His movies tend to be in my wheelhouse. Subject matter is always right up my alley. I mean, and when it isn't, you know, so be it. I move on. I find another movie to watch. But the reason I enjoy the guy so much is because of the movies that he does make, because of the choices that he makes, and because I just, even when I see something like Matchstick Men, where I'm kind of like, I'm struck out of left field, and I sit down and watch it, and I was like, you know what, that was a really great freaking movie. You know, it's not something I revisit a whole lot, because it's not, you know, to my taste in particular, but you still have to objectively look at it and say, that's a really well-made little thriller, mm-hmm. You know? And that's, I think, his big thing. I mean, I'd love to, there's more stuff I'd love to see him tackle. I'd love to see him do a Western, but then I'd love to see every director do a Western, you know?
I would definitely go to see that.
There you go. That's what he was supposed to do. There was a Cormac McCarthy story. It was a Western story.
Blood Meridian?
Yeah, he had been signed on for Blood Meridian. He had actually signed a deal, and it was all go.
Oh, that would have been amazing.
Yeah, but I think with Blood Meridian, it's just a situation of finding a script that could actually work as a film, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm amazed that Hillcoat managed to pull it off with The Road, because it was just such a not movie-like novel, you know? But I just, I don't know. I mean,
and yet he made the crowd pleaser that he did.
Just such a cheerful movie. But yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there I'd like to see him tackle. And I think whatever he does, we can always look forward to a Ridley Scott flick. We can always afford to at least being intrigued by his choices. It's always going to be something to talk about.
Word.
Yep.
On that note, thanks, gentlemen, for joining me. Thanks, people, for listening.
Are we pimping or next?
We are going to be sure to tune in when next we meet, when we tackle. Who are we tackling?
Neil Jordan.
Neil Jordan.
Yes, it's a fairly unknown director who's done a lot of stuff. Mainly, most known movies are probably The Crying Game, Michael Collins, and Interview with the Vampire.
Should be interesting.
Should be a fun time. Be sure to tune in. Thanks for listening. And stop.
Okay, so I have to know, since I'm...